This is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's show, one man's lonely quest to educate kids deep in the mountains of rural China.
Sometimes when I lie in my bed at night, I'm ready to give up. Life's too hard. I make so little money. But when I see the children in the morning and their craving for knowledge, it touches my heart.
A thrift store in Massachusetts offers bargains for buyers hit by the recession.
We make money off shoes, yes. We get good quality shoes. We get all kinds. We get top notch. We get Prada. Go ahead, sweetheart. Help yourself.
And music from Palestinian hip-hop artist Mohammed Al-Farah. Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's difficult for children in rural China to get a good education. In rural areas, teachers are few and far between. Many of them have been lured by the higher wages and easier life in urban areas. There are exceptions, of course, like Li Xiaopeng. He's committed to teaching rural children under the harshest of conditions. Ruth Kirshner reports from a remote area of Shaanxi Province.
Li Xiaopeng stands at the blackboard explaining how to add and subtract. His old checker jacket is too big for his small frame. Li's black shoes are covered in the dust of the classroom's mud floor. A dozen students sit in the dimly lit room. They range from 5 to 12 years old. Their white and blue desks have seen better days. Wind and rain blow in through the wide cracks in the wooden door, and the roof leaks. This is the primary school where 37-year-old Li Xiaopeng has been teaching for the past 9 years. He gets paid just $15 a month. He lives in a single room next door to the school, which is an hour's walk uphill from the small village of Donggan. Li has no bathroom, no television, and no heat. He prepares lunch for his students, corn porridge and some pickled vegetables, on a small fireplace in his bedroom.
The conditions in this area are very poor. We get hardly any wheat flour to eat. People grow a little bit of corn, that's it. On the footpath on the way up, you might have noticed that there are hardly any fields here.
Li's students live on small farms in the surrounding hills. Many are the children of migrant workers who've left this impoverished area to seek their luck in the big cities in the east. For the children who were left behind with relatives, it's a hard life.
I believe that only through education can these children change the course of their lives. Education will give them the skills to leave this poor mountainous region behind.
One of Li's students is 11-year-old Wei Bing. The girl with long black braids lives with her grandparents and her younger sister. Every morning, she walks an hour and a half to reach the dilapidated schoolhouse.
I like my teacher a lot. He's showing us a lot of things. Because we live so far away, he also cooks for us at lunchtime, so we don't have to go home to eat. I like learning. I want to become a scientist and leave the mountains when I grow up.
Teacher Li knows what it means to want an education. He grew up in these mountains and had to give up studying because his family was too poor.
It was always my dream to go to university and become a teacher. Back in 1989, I was preparing for the college entrance exam. My school had recommended me to one of the best universities in the country. But then my father had a bad accident and injured his spine. I had to stay home. Even if I had taken the exam and passed it, there would have been nobody to pay for my education.
Li managed to become a teacher after all, but he first started working in a local government office. That's when he noticed that very few children from remote areas were enrolled in the village schools. He set off on a mission to change that. Li persuaded the local government to let him use an abandoned police station in the mountains to set up his own school. He even got a teacher's diploma through a correspondence course. But his own achievements mean little to him. It's the students who matter, he says, as he starts leafing through some old files.
12 of my former students have made it to the university. 9 of them already found a job. For the other students, I found a vocational school nearby. They can train there as chefs or drivers and pay their tuition fees later.
During break time, the children play on the dirt track in front of the schoolhouse. Experts believe thousands of underserved schools like this still exist in rural China. Last year, a charity offered to build a new school here, but the village leaders flatly refused. Instead, they insisted the money would be better spent on a much-needed new road. Li is determined to carry on, even without support from the village. Back in his classroom, Li leads the children in a traditional song about sunshine, joy and happiness. He admits that sometimes the going is tough.
Sometimes when I lie in my bed at night, I'm ready to give up. Life's too hard. I make so little money. As a migrant worker, I could easily earn almost $300 a month. But when I see the children in the morning and they're craving for knowledge, it touches my heart. And I know I have to carry on.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Ruth Kirchner in Shaanxi Province, China.
As you've just heard, parents in some countries have to leave their children with relatives in rural areas and go to cities to find work. Sometimes they may be the very people working in factories that make our clothes, like the husband and wife in China who glue our flip-flops, or the single mother in Bangladesh who stitches our t-shirts. In his book, Where Am I Wearing?, writer Kelsey Timmerman traced his five favorite items of clothing back to their countries of origin. During his travels, he was charmed by the hospitality of the workers he met, and he tried to come up with unique ways to express his gratitude. In Bangladesh, Kelsey took a group of kids to an amusement park. In Cambodia, he took garment workers bowling. But in China, he says, he faced a challenge.
Duan and his wife Zhu Chun work at the factory that made my flip-flops. They told me it wasn't unusual to work more than 100 hours in a week. If they complained about the hours, they would lose their jobs, and they couldn't afford that. A few years ago, they had taken out a loan to build a two-story home in their village. Shortly after the home was finished, Duan's mother became ill and died, but not before racking up expensive medical bills. So they came to Guangzhou 3 years ago to get jobs and pay down their debt. With precious little free time, they prepared home-cooked meals for me and answered all of my questions. I wanted to repay their kindness, so I invited them out for pizza. I'd found out that they had never eaten pizza, or, for that matter, cheese. This was a wrong I could right. No, we have to work. On Sundays, they're scheduled to get off early, so I called them. How about a little karaoke tonight? No, we have to work. The thing that I haven't told you yet about Duan and Zhu Chun, the really heartbreaking part, is that they have a son. Li Shen is 13 and lives in their home village 600 miles away. They haven't seen him in 3 years. What's more, I noticed that there were no visible signs of him in their tiny apartment. No drawings, no letters, not even a photo. I offered to pay their train fares to go visit him, but, no surprise, they had to work. But they encouraged me to go alone to see their village and meet Li Shen, and that's what I did. Unlike the city, the air in the village carried neither the muggy scent of progress nor the hustle and bustle of honking horns. Their son had a shy exterior, but you could see the mischief in his eyes, his dad's eyes. I brought him a shiny new soccer ball, the terrace fields made plain with it a challenge. Before I left, Li Shen gave me a tour of the two-story home he lived in with his granddad. This is my parents' room, he said. Nobody has stayed in this room for a long time. When I got back to Guangzhou, I called Duan and Zhu Chun. Can I come over? I have a gift for you. Finally, I thought I'd come up with the perfect way to repay their hospitality. As soon as Duan arrived from another late night at the factory, I reached into my bag and handed his wife a framed 8x10 photo of Li Shen laughing with his cousin. Behind them, green terraces of corn stretched to the horizon, not a skyscraper, highway, or factory in sight. Zhu Chun lost herself in the photo before passing it to Duan. He smiled sadly and made a remark about the state of the crop. Zhu Chun put the photo in a plastic bag and slid it behind the bed. I had thought the framed photo would go right to the wall, or perhaps a privileged place on the nightstand. Maybe I should have brought over a large pepperoni pizza after all. One thing is for sure, Zhu Chun said. I don't want him to come here to work in the factory. I just want him to study, because people like us who don't have the knowledge have to work very hard. I wonder if there are other photos of Li Shen tucked away in the nooks and crannies of the room, looked at occasionally, and then put away again. Perhaps the photos are not just reminders of what they are working for. Perhaps they are also painful reminders of what they are missing.
Kelsey Timmerman is the author of Where Am I Wearing? A Global Tour to the Countries, Factories, and People That Make Our Clothes. Kelsey says flip-flops are his footwear of choice, and he no longer takes them for granted. Mamadou Barry had to strike out on his own at an early age. Unlike Li Shen, the child Kelsey Timmerman met in China, Mamadou has no parents sacrificing for his future. He's had to figure it out himself. Mamadou works as a mechanic's apprentice, and he sleeps on his boss's living room floor. Tough as that may sound, Mamadou still dreams of a better future. From Guinea on the west coast of Africa, here's his story in his own words.
My name is Mamadou Alou Berry. I am 13, going on 14. My parents gave me to someone who had the same last name as them. That man promised us that I would go to school, but I never went. He died, and then his children started beating me, so I fled and was taken in by a neighbor. He used to force me to break rocks with his other children. What we did was used by people who were building houses, but I was never paid. I was also beaten when I did that work. Now I am learning to become a mechanic. I prefer this because it will contribute to my future. I do everything here that is needed to fix cars, motors, suspensions. I'm not earning anything yet, but I hope money will come later. Sometimes someone here will give me money to find food. What is important is to learn to become a mechanic. It takes me 1 hour to walk here. I wake up at 6, pray, and go to work, but I don't have anything to eat in the morning. Sometimes, here, someone will give me enough money to buy beans. I leave here at 7 or 8 at night. Sometimes, when I get home, there is something to eat. Sometimes, there is nothing. I'm wearing a soccer jersey because it's easy to wash, but I don't play soccer. I don't have the time. I just want to become a better mechanic, that's all. I have never been to school. When I have children, I hope they will be able to go to school, and I will never abandon them.
Mamadou's story was produced for us by Nico Columbant. When the going gets tough, the tough go shopping at the thrift store. That story ahead on the World Vision Report after a short break. I'm Peggy Waymire. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. There's no getting away from it. The economic downturn affected us all. You can see it on main streets across the country, where businesses have closed down and jobs have disappeared. Like in downtown Chelsea, Massachusetts. On Broadway, the main drag there, a former bank building now houses a laundromat. And one of the anchor storefronts has turned into a thrift store. The Salvation Army store, with its bright red awning, is full of bargains for people who badly need them. But people also go there to find company and common ground and a pair of shoes for $5. Chris Burrell spent a recent weekday there and filed this report.
It's barely a half hour since this Salvation Army store opened, and already 20 shoppers clog the aisles and click through clothes hangers.
$1.99 and $1. It is $3 total.
Not surprisingly, sales and transactions at this store have climbed in recent months. Cashiers now ring up $40,000 a month, nearly a 10% increase from last year.
We make money off shoes, yes. We get good quality shoes, we get all kinds, we get top notch, we get Prada. Yeah, we do. I've seen several names. Go ahead, sweetheart, help yourself.
Store employee Annie Webb tidies up the shoe display.
you can get a good pair of shoes no more than $5. Pair of sneakers for $5. Pair of nice heels to go out in for $4. Yeah.
But for Annie Webb, the job means more than cold cash and numbers.
It's a good social scene for me. I love interacting with people and trying to help them the best I can. I know half the city now, basically, from working here, so it's awesome. Actually, you know what? Take a walk with me. I do got some dresses. Hi.
The customer is Puerto Rican, and like many who shop here, English is her second language. Customers are from all over the map, say cashiers Bertha and Paul.
Most of all the Spanish people come here. Yeah. Guatemala, Salvador, Mexico, Honduras, Africa, yes? Africa, right? Yeah.
By noontime, you could add Haiti, Brazil, Somalia, Cambodia, and Kosovo to the atlas of shoppers. A lot of thrift shops can feel like dreary caverns, but this place is festive, with music and laughter. And there's often food, brought in by grateful customers like Susan Usall, and doled out among the 9 shop employees.
Muffins.
Save me one.
What kind did you make today?
Mixed berry.
Nice.
Thank you, Susan.
While workers snack on her muffins, Usall rummages through some plates.
So this is my favorite place. I especially like antique linen napkins. So they'll save them for me. So they're cool. They're cool here, you know.
Susan comes in every day to shop. Others, like Laura Dewing, wait until they feel called to shop.
I don't come here unless I really feel the urge to, and then I know there's something waiting for me. Well, actually, I pray about it and ask the Lord to lead me so I don't waste my time. And he has the deals waiting for me.
By 1:30, the cash registers have shifted into high gear.
5 or 2, they change. Next.
The checkout line is 7 deep. And the door chimes are working overtime. Over at the record section, a Cambodian immigrant is on the hunt for blues and jazz albums. Kids cozy up on sofas as they read books near the store's big front window. It's a scene that 86-year-old volunteer Almont Bracey loves. Bracey comes in the store just about every day.
With a pleasant smile, they walk out the door. You know, they're satisfied. Regardless of what their income is, they're happy. That's great. That makes me feel good. Yeah, it does. When I'm away from it, I miss it. I miss it because I know what's going on, and I just like to watch it. Watch it happen.
Bracey is quite a sight himself. He sports a fedora and a small silver hoop earring in his left ear. And a greeting from Bracey always comes with a smile and a handshake. You'll spot him with a broom in his hands or straightening up the bric-a-brac.
I just delve into doing things. All of a sudden, it starts piling up around me. That's the way this place is. I love it.
But Bracey downplays his influence over the place.
That's part of my whole thing. I'm just furniture, you know?
But ask some of the younger folks about Bracey, like 21-year-old employee Carlos Perez, and you'll get a different answer.
Bracey's, he's like a legend out here. He's like, when you talk to him and he gives you advice, it's like, the only thing you can do is just be quiet and listen, you know?
It's a dimension to this place that can't be measured by the day's receipts. A relationship forged across a divide of 6 decades. Connections built over a tray of fresh-baked muffins. In a downtown thrift store that feels like a neighbor's front porch. For the World Vision Report, I'm Chris Burrell in Chelsea, Massachusetts.
Thank you very, very much.
You can see and hear from some people who shop at the store on our website, worldvisionreport.org. In spite of the recession, it appears that more Americans are saving money these days. And it may be hard to believe, but some street kids in India are doing it too. Here's our globe at a glance. The rules are pretty simple. There's a minimum balance, there's a 3.5% interest rate on all money deposited, and all the customers and employees have to be under 18. Welcome to the Child Development Bank, a bank for street kids in India. The first branch was a bright yellow booth in the corner of a night shelter in New Delhi. When business there boomed, the aid group that came up with the idea started 14 new branches. Now, about 8,000 kids have deposited more than $36,000 in banks across India and neighboring countries. The branches are all in places where street kids hang out. Railway stations, bus terminals, and crowded markets. Most of the children are runaways who left behind families living in desperate poverty. The city offers them a chance to make some money, selling tea, collecting trash, or shining shoes. The bank offers them a safe place to put their money, away from the thieves and thugs they normally have to contend with. As the boys watch their savings grow, their dreams for their future grow too. Many have enrolled in the school run by the shelter, where they're acquiring skills that will help them escape a life of poverty. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymire.
That endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Using music to make a statement is nothing new. Protest songs have long been part of popular culture, and today those songs often take the form of hip-hop. In many parts of the developing world, hip-hop has become the music of choice to express the fears and frustrations of the millions who struggle with poverty and injustice. In this next story, reporter Lydia Crafts introduces us to a hip-hop artist from Gaza.
Assalamu alaikum, everybody!
Peace be unto you. Mohammed Al-Faraz says at a recent concert he gave in New York City.
All the people in the back, do you love Palestine? Yeah. Okay, well, stand up! Stand up and come closer. Let's get together.
The audience is an eclectic mix of hip-hop fans and activists. They raise their fists and bounce their heads to his song, Anajit, Arabic for I Have Arrived. The song describes Al-Faraz's emergence as a hip-hop artist in Gaza. The 24-year-old has a slight build, but his style is bold. He wears a Solidarity with Gaza t-shirt and shouts out words in Arabic for the crowd to learn.
It's Palestinian.
Palestinian!
Which means because you are a Palestinian, or a Palestinian. This song I talk about myself because I'm a Palestinian. I'm not allowed to leave my country because I'm a Palestinian.
Al-Faraz discovered hip-hop when he was 10 years old. He says he identified with the experiences of African-Americans.
They used to talk about violence between white and black and stuff like that, and racism. So I figured out that I can do it in Arabic, and I can do it about my life in Gaza Strip and how we are struggling from the occupation.
But he didn't become serious about hip-hop until he was 16. Al-Faraz was participating in a protest against Israeli settlements. The protest became violent, and Al-Faraz says he was shot in the arm.
I couldn't even feel anything in my arm. But I pulled up my shirt and was like all bloody, you know. So I was like, what should I do now? Where should I go?
Al-Faraz recovered from the injury, but he had to answer to his father, also a singer, who had always encouraged his son not to use violence.
And he was like, you need to think deeply. This is not how I taught you to think. Do you want to fight the occupation? You need to find a way to fight the occupation. Because if you want to fight it this way, you will end up killed. And nobody, you didn't do a change in the world.
So Al-Faraz turned to hip-hop as his way to peacefully protest. In 2003, he and three of his friends formed the first hip-hop group in Gaza. They called themselves the Palestinian Rappers, or PR. In 2004, PR put on Gaza's first hip-hop show. More than 500 people attended. One of them was American filmmaker Jackie Reem Saloom. Saloom filmed the concert for her award-winning documentary about Palestinian hip-hop artists called Slingshot Hip-Hop. She said hip-hop's popularity spread fast in Gaza.
You're living in a piece of land that's 26 miles long, 4 miles wide, and you're completely surrounded. Like, you cannot get out. It's an open-air prison. And so a lot of these kids are just frustrated and don't have a way to, like, you know, express themselves, get out what they're feeling. So what hip-hop did was give them a tool to focus on something fun and cool.
After the concert, PR established a loyal following, and eventually Al-Faraz released a solo album. While most of the material focuses on the Israeli occupation, one song is about his first love, the hookah, the water pipe that's used for smoking tobacco. But Al-Faraz's newfound fame caught the attention of Muslim extremists who believe hip-hop is sinful because of its Western origins. At one concert, they physically attacked PR, and then Al-Faraz was personally threatened.
Phone calls, hey, are you the guy who do rap? Yeah, I mean, oh, someday we'll catch you. It can make you mentally go crazy.
Al-Faraz started keeping a lower profile to avoid danger. Then, last year, the Sundance Film Festival brought him to the U.S. for the premiere of Slingshot Hip Hop. He decided to stay and was granted asylum in the U.S. Today, in his living room in Dallas, Al-Faraz is recording new vocals. The room's decorated with a poster of the Palestinian flag. Notebooks filled with song lyrics are scattered across his coffee table. A friend mixes his lyrics and beats together.
Well, here, you know what? Instead of doing that,
yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Go ahead and give me this middle, too.
I was thinking that. That's what I was thinking.
And then, yeah, there you go.
It's been a while since he's recorded music. He can't afford a studio. Still, Al-Faraz is determined.
What's still making me going on this? The people who are struggling in Gaza, the people who really need help, the people who doesn't have voice there.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Lydia Crafts in Dallas.
Not everyone's listening to hip-hop. Here's another song that's been on the charts in Gaza. Singer Shireen Abdel Wahab with the song Habayt. Been listening to a popular song from the Middle East. Now, let's sample one of the region's favorite dishes. Ma'aloube is a Palestinian classic. Daniel Estrin learned how to make this colorful dish from one of Jerusalem's most colorful chefs.
The most important thing about ma'aloube is that you serve it ma'aloube. That's Arabic for upside down.
The casserole has to be turned upside down on a tray. Then the whole rice plus the vegetables plus the meat make one very nice looking mold.
Ali Klebo is no amateur when it comes to ma'aloube. He's a gourmet chef, as well as oil painter, anthropologist, and writer, a Palestinian Renaissance man.
Every piece of rice must stick together. The whole thing must make a beautiful mold and not fall to pieces.
Today, Ali will prepare ma'aloube in his small kitchen, which barely had enough room for all of his jars of hand-picked herbs. The ingredients in ma'aloube are simple.
I think it's the most typical Palestinian dish because it's made of the product of the land. It's really like a dish that has been carved of the ecology of the country.
You prepare all of the ingredients separately before you combine them into the casserole. First, you start with 1 pound of eggplants, also called aubergines. You peel them and cut them into round slices. Then you chop up the meat and cook it in a pot. Ali gets his leg of lamb from his favorite butcher.
Brown the meat on all the sides in the very hot oil. It smells delicious already.
Then Ali adds some spices to the meat before he cooks it on a low flame for an hour and a half.
So where do you buy your spices?
I buy it from my favorite. He's our neighbor too. His shop is right in the old bazaar in the old city. But I have my special walk when I buy my spices. That's when I buy my cardamom, my coriander, my cumin, my fresh pepper. It's a 10-minute nice walk, but it never takes me 10 minutes. It always takes me 1 hour to walk to my butcher and to my spice man because I have to say good morning to everyone. So it's never a simple process.
Now it's time to...
Excuse me.
It's a pepper.
It's the pepper.
Okay. Cannot be sensitive around my kitchen.
Okay, so now it's time to chop a large, bumpy tomato.
So where does this tomato come from exactly? Where did you get it?
It's of Hebron. I take my long rides in the mountains and I buy my tomatoes and products, the vegetables, from the mountains.
Then Ali's secret ingredient, green pepper.
This is very, very controversial.
Everything is controversial here in the Middle East.
No, pepper in this is... It's a sort of blasphemous one. How could you put green pepper in the ma'aloube? In my family, they were surprised. I added the first time the green pepper. It's smell the pepper. It's delicious. This, I think, is what gives my maklouba its special taste and what makes everyone fall in love with it once they have eaten it.
Now it's time to fry the eggplant slices. Then, in a big pot, Ali pours a cup of water, brings it to a boil, and then stacks the ingredients into colorful layers. Tomato slices first, then the eggplants and green peppers, then the tender lamb meat. He adds a cup of rice and distributes it evenly before covering the pot and lowering the flame for some slow cooking. Outside the kitchen window, the sun sets behind the Jerusalem hills. Ali takes pride in the view. His mother's Muslim family has safeguarded the key to Jesus' traditional burial place since the 7th century. And his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a famous Islamic theologian. His clothes are displayed in a museum at the Dome of the Rock, one of Islam's holiest sites.
So when I'm in Jerusalem, I'm at home.
About an hour later, Ali's sous chef takes over, his daughter Aida. This is her favorite part.
I hit it. I hit the pan with the wooden spoon so that nothing sticks up. Everything goes down. The eggplants, the tomato, the sweet pepper, everything goes down. Nothing gets, and the rice.
So nothing gets stuck in the pot.
Mm-hmm.
You look a little worried.
Now we have to say a little prayer. Always, 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 this I forgot to say. Whenever Muslims cook, every step they say, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. That's the beginning of every chapter of the Quran, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Why?
So that the devil does not interfere. So you always have God's grace in every morsel.
This is the big moment, right?
It's the first time I do it.
Aida flips the pot over onto a metal tray and lifts it up.
Oh,
it looks...
Take picture.
Beautiful. Success. The upside-down mold is perfectly intact, but only for a moment.
I have to taste it. I can't wait to eat.
What can I say? It just melts in your mouth. And Aida's dogs are waiting for the leftovers.
Wow.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
It's really amazing.
Oh, do you have eggplants?
Mm-hmm.
You can make maklouba at home. Ali promises it's easier than it sounds. You can find the recipe at our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, why the Green Revolution backfired, and can the problem be fixed? Hear the answer just ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Norman Borlaug, the father of the Green Revolution, died earlier this year. Borlaug won a Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to end world hunger. The Green Revolution lived up to its name. It revolutionized agriculture in Asia. It all began in the 1950s when scientists, led by Borlaug, created new, more productive types of grain. Farmers began using large amounts of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, which the new grains required. As a result, harvests of food staples like wheat and rice doubled or even tripled in some parts of the world. It seemed like a hunger-ending dream come true. But in India, the Green Revolution, once full of such promise, had unintended consequences. Joel Bourne wrote about them in a recent edition of National Geographic magazine. He explains why Borlaug's new wheat was such an improvement.
The old wheat varieties were very tall, and when you got a lot of wheat in the head, they would fall over, and then they would rot on the ground and be wasted. So Borlaug very ingeniously developed a very short, stocky wheat that only grew about knee-high that would really take all this excess nitrogen from chemical fertilizer and just pour it into the grain. So he was able to double, even triple yields, but they depended on fairly large amounts of chemical fertilizer inputs, lots of water, so lots of irrigation, and very little competition because suddenly you were growing a really dense crop.
So this crop really took off in India?
No, it absolutely did. And there was a huge push by the government of India to get the irrigation canals dug, to get individual pump sets, tube wells, what they call them, for individual farmers, and to get these seeds. And they subsidized both the tube wells, the electricity to run them, as well as nitrogen fertilizer. They got this into the hands of the farmers, and within about 3 years, it was a period of 3 to 5 years between 67 and 72, their yields increased sixfold from the drought years of the 60s. They had so much wheat those first couple of years, they had to, according to one Indian scientist who I spoke to, They had to close schools a month early just to store the excess wheat in the schools.
It was just wheat that made the difference then. Is that the only grain that was part of this green revolution?
No. Very soon after Borlaug made his great advancements with wheat, another researcher at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines came up with a very similar type of rice. They called it miracle rice. And again, using the same sort of techniques and technologies, they were able to just rapidly increase rice yields around the world. Essentially, what happened, they started to reduce the amount of times it took for these crops to get ripe. And so suddenly you could grow two crops a year instead of one. So now in the Punjab, they went from growing 200 different varieties of crops, you know, vegetables, legumes, you know, the whole nine yards, to growing basically three, cotton, wheat, and rice. And that's been the mainstay pretty much since the early 1970s.
So what impact did this actually have on the country? What difference did it make for the economy, for the cities, for agriculture?
In the beginning, it was tremendous. Farmers were getting three times the yield for the same amount of work. And the Indian government was getting just enough grain to feed all its people in the other parts of India that don't grow wheat or rice. Incomes went up in the Punjab. People were able to move off the farm and find work in the cities. Just the sort of the typical demographic transition from agrarian to a more modern economy. They have not had a famine since the Borlaug seeds came to India.
But then in your article, you take a turn and you write that what's happening now in the country as a result of the Green Revolution isn't really so pretty. You went to India, you looked into this, and I'd like you to tell us, if you can, what's happening now in the agricultural fields where all these crops were planted?
Sure. Basically, the bloom is off the rose big time for the Green Revolution in India, because whereas crop yields were steadily increasing throughout the 70s, 3, 4, sometimes even 5% a year, in the early 1990s, they started to stagnate. So suddenly, they weren't getting greater yields than they had been. So the yields flattened. And then suddenly, they started having all kinds of problems with the aquifer. The aquifer became, in many places, particularly the southern part of the Punjab, full of pesticides, full of fertilizers, really unhealthy to drink. And so suddenly you had this burgeoning of cancers in the southern part of the Punjab, particularly where the water was really problematic.
Is that because of the fertilizers and pesticides?
That's what many think. And the government has been so concerned about it, they started to put these municipal filters in some of these villages to try to clean up the water. Because they found pesticides in the Punjabis' blood, in their breast milk, in their water table, in their water that they're drinking. I mean, it's endemic.
And you said the cancer rates went up, right?
Cancer rates have gone up tremendously. Now,
how bad?
Well, it's really difficult to get a handle on cancer rate, because there's no cancer survey or registry in rural India. They're just getting started getting cancer registries done in the cities. But in the rural Punjab, they're still behind. Now, they're attempting to do that now. But in some of the villages I would go to, like I went to several that were about 5,000 people, and it would be immediately introduced to 30 folks who either had cancer or had relatives that had cancer, and, you know, would visit survivors of cancers. And it was just tragic. And every time you go to some place, you say, we're having a major problem. The water is bad, and people are dying of this cancer that we never had before.
So it sounds like this miracle green revolution has backfired somewhat.
It has. It's basically exacted an enormous environmental toll on both the land and the people, because the land is basically sterile. In a lot of the cases, they irrigated so much that they waterlogged many of the irrigated areas. So it becomes too soft. I mean, too full of water for them to farm. A lot of cases, this causes an increase in salinity. So you get the salts coming up that make it basically barren. Nothing can grow there. That's part of the problem as well. You know, they have to add every nutrient to it to make the crops grow. They've gone from growing more than 200 different varieties of crops that are very healthy and sold locally to basically growing three crops, most of which they export out of the state of Punjab. According to one local school teacher I interviewed, you know, who was very adamant about this, he said essentially the government of India has sold the people of the Punjab for grain.
Mm. So what are agricultural leaders in India saying they're going to do to solve this problem? Because it looks like they might be on the verge of a food crisis if they don't find the remedy to this, because population is certainly continuing to grow.
Well, this is the ultimate question that I tried to pose in the story. So India is supposed to get, what, 1.2 billion here in the next 20 years? They're going to take over from China as being the most populous country in the world. Yes, they are extremely worried. And yet, when I spoke to some of the Indian pioneers who were very involved in the Green Revolution technology, very supportive of it, they are calling for a new Green Revolution, but one that's kinder, gentler, easier on the environment, which amazed me. I mean, this has done such a good thing for them and saved them from such real utter misery. And yet now one of the gentlemen I spoke to, who was head of vice president of agriculture for Punjab in the 60s, said, you know, we can do Green Revolution for the grains, but it is our duty to do organic for dairy and vegetables, because we know that that's healthier.
So they're looking at growing more food using fewer pesticides and fertilizers as an extension of the Green Revolution?
This is the whole mantra about how we're going to be able to get out of this mess that we're in, and not just India's in, but everybody's in, as to how to grow more food with less inputs. Because if you think about it, all of our fertilizers, all of our pesticides are derived from fossil fuels or either take an enormous amount of fossil fuels to produce. And as you know, last year, during the middle of this food crisis or food price crisis, you know, the price of a barrel of oil went up to over $140 a barrel. So that's directly related to the price of nitrogen fertilizer. And in Africa, of course, and in other places, it increased fivefold within a six-month span. It's just incredible. So as we look at the end of cheap energy, we're going to have to find ways to produce, not just stay the same, but almost double our food production with fewer inputs.
I'd like to take a turn to Africa. You mentioned Africa, and I know you've visited some areas there where they're working on this. The Green Revolution never really made it there, but some major thinkers like Bill Gates are saying it's time for a Green Revolution in Africa. What does Bill Gates and what do the others like him say needs to happen now in Africa?
Right now, there are two schools of thought. They're thinking, okay, Africa's going to be one of the largest population growth in the next 20 to 30 years. They're already one of the areas that is perennially food stressed, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. So people like Gates, people like the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, have put a lot of money into a new group called A Green Revolution for Africa that's run by former UN Secretary Kofi Annan. I mean, the biggest problem with Africa and agriculture is soils are incredibly infertile. They're old. You know, this is a very old continent. The soils have been farmed continuously throughout humanity. So their big push, let's get some fertility into these soils. Let's, you know, get fertilizer onto these farmers' fields. And that's the quickest, easiest way, even for small farmers, we can increase yields and feed a lot of people and get great benefit.
Well, we've just pointed out all the consequences of doing this with fertilizers and pesticides in India. How are the lessons from India being applied in Africa, or are they paying attention to what happened in India?
Well, see, that's a very good question, because there are other groups who are nowhere near as well-funded as the Gates Foundation who are saying, look, we made mistakes in India, and we're paying the consequences of that with people's health and with people's lives. Let's not make the same mistakes in Africa. And they're pushing a much more, it's called agroecology, sort of an ecological approach to increasing yields in Africa. So instead of applying, you know, 50-pound bag of nitrogen fertilizer to a farmer's cornfields, they're advocating rotating in with legumes, soybeans, groundnuts, you know, things that will provide nitrogen and fertility to the soil without, and that are locally available, that you don't have to import from around the world that are incredibly expensive rates to get to these poor farmers' fields. I visited two programs in Malawi, one of which is, you know, partially funded by the Gates Foundation and the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, and another which was a small nonprofit run in the northern part of Malawi that was doing exactly the opposite. They were both getting very similar results, except the one in the northern part of the country was doing it at a tenth of the cost of the one in the southern part. Villages in the southern part, they get free seeds, free hybrid seeds, much of it donated by Monsanto. They get free fertilizer. They get, you know, nice clean water provided for them. You know, they have a lot of benefits. They have a lot of money. You know, the critics of that program say, well, there's no way we can maintain that. This is obviously a short duration thing. But, you know, as an example of what can be done, yeah, it's fantastic. Now, in the northern part, they are using what fertilizer they can acquire in Malawi, but the vast majority of it is focused on this diversified cropping rotation, very similar to the organic movement back in the United States, where you're trying to build the soil Your entire focus is on feeding the soil, feeding the soil, feeding the soil. So you have fertile soil, you have a diversified crop, you have animals that will contribute to the soil, you know, pigs, cows, chickens, goats.
Now, this is just the opposite of what was happening in India. So they did learn these lessons from India. Instead of just doing three crops and ruining the soil, they're rotating it all.
They're growing truck crops, you know, vegetable crops for market crops that's getting them extra cash. They're growing small livestock, and they're finding, you know, just incredible results.
After what you just told us about Africa and the challenges there, how relevant is the Indian Green Revolution model as we go into the future?
Well, I think there's going to be a tremendous push from folks like the Gates Foundation and from the big agricultural and biotech industries to keep on this sort of classic Green Revolution model in Africa. But there's also started to be a pretty major pushback. There have been two great, huge UN reports that basically have said that a sustainable solution, sustainable agriculture, has much more to offer the subsistence African farmer than sort of the Green Revolution model. The Swaminathan, M.S. Swaminathan, who was sort of the Borlaug of India, has said we need an evergreen revolution, one that will continue to increase the abundance of food products but not harm the environment. And I think that's going to be the goal for everyone. Now, whether it's one, the other, or as I sort of hinted at the article, a blend of both, remains to be seen. But it certainly seems that there's, you know, the sort of sustainable organic ag movement is much stronger, much more powerful, has much more science behind it now than it did, say, 30, 40 years ago. You know, it'll be up to Africa, other countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, to make the decision on how best to feed their people.
Well, I think it's fair to say we can anticipate a great debate in the coming years over this topic.
I think you're right.
Joel Byrne wrote The Global Food Crisis, The End of Plenty for National Geographic. Joel, thank you for sharing what you learned with us.
Thank you, Peggy. It's been a pleasure.
You can find a link to Joel's article on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Healthcare is a hot topic right now, and not only in the United States. A recent report from Amnesty International says that healthcare in Sierra Leone is woefully inadequate. No surprises there, but some of the statistics may be hard to believe. For instance, there are just 78 doctors for 5.8 million people. Most Sierra Leoneans depend on local herbalists to treat everything from epilepsy to typhoid. Reporter Rochelle Borlase recently traveled to rural Sierra Leone, and in this reporter's notebook, we hear about a woman she befriended.
The first time I saw Kumba Kamara, she was slumped on a mat by the side of her house. Her right foot and calf were wrapped in a filthy cloth. Her face was squinting in pain. Her tiny baby cried on a mat beside her, but she didn't have the energy to lift him. Kumba told me 3 weeks prior she'd been bitten by a snake while walking barefoot in the bush. Her sister carried her back to the village where she was treated by the local herbalist. He swathed the wound with ground leaves and performed a ceremony by a smoking fire. Then he told Kumba Kamara her fate was left to God. I convinced Kumba to let me bring her to the government hospital. At first she didn't want to go, afraid the doctor would amputate her leg. The traditional healer lurked around the car as her family lifted her into the back seat. His filthy fingernails clutched the window, trying to convince her to stay home. He was making $5 for treating Kumba. She was a patient he couldn't afford to lose. At the McKinney Government Hospital, sick patients lined up against its grimy walls. This is where some of the world's poorest people scraped together enough money to be seen by a real doctor. A young nurse unraveled the cloth from Kumba's wound that stretched from the tip of her toes to her mid-calf. The nurse said he'd never seen such a terrible bite, but thought he could save her leg. Then he cleaned the wound and swathed it in fresh bandages. Kumba was admitted into the hospital, and I visited her frequently, hoping to see improvement. At first, Kumba seemed more depressed than when I first found her. She said she was still in pain and missed her family at home. But in her third week, Kumba was able to limp her way to the operating room for her daily dressing changes. Shortly after that, she resumed breastfeeding her baby, who'd been staying with her in the hospital. Then she began to sit with the other mothers in the female ward, chatting as they washed their laundry in plastic buckets. After 7 weeks in the hospital, Kumba was told she could return home. This time, she could climb into the car that drove her home. I brought Kumba to the same spot I found her, just outside of her house. She sat on a bench and cradled her baby in her arms. And for the first time since I'd met her, I saw her smile.
Rochelle Borlase is a reporter for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And that's it for this week. Remember to check out our website for photos, recipes, and blogs from our reporters around the world. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. I'm Peggy Waymeyer.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Them sitting on their luxuries, with the hope to swallow more. Ready to threat and steal from the weaker ones and the defenseless citizens. Hey! Bull! 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 Bull!